We'll read from Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1, verse 24. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. We're thinking about this great truth, the truth that God created man. And we've dealt with three aspects of that so far. We've said that God created man by a distinct, separate act of creation. He was created separately from all the animals. Secondly, we've said God created man as the climax of his creating work. Man was created as the very apex of the natural order. And then thirdly, we've said God created man in his own image. It's there in verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now the fourth truth, the fourth aspect that I want us to think about tonight is this. God created man to have dominion. God is the ultimate sovereign of all things. The world, the universe is his. He has dominion over it all. And as man was created to be God's image bearer, to mirror God, man was created then to have dominion under God. Man was created to be king, under God's kingship, to be king over the whole created order. You see here that was always God's purpose. Verse 26, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground. In the earlier part of the chapter, we've seen the great divisions of the created order. God makes the sky, God makes the sea, God makes the dry land. And now God says, let us make man to rule over all these divisions. He's to rule over the sky creatures. He's to rule over the sea creatures. He's to rule over the land creatures. They're all to be under the dominion of man. God's purpose was that man should have dominion, that man should be king over the created order. And that then was the mandate that God gave to man. By a mandate, I simply mean a command. A command that gives you both a duty and the authority to do something. God speaks to man in verse 28. He speaks to the first couple, to Adam and Eve. And he gives them this mandate, he gives them this command, which carries with it authority. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Theologians have called this the cultural mandate. A mandate that commands man to develop culture. That could be a misleading word. When we use the word culture today, what springs to mind is arty people producing grotesque sculptures that look like nothing and making awful music that sounds like nothing on earth. We think, oh, that's culture. I want nothing to do with culture. But the word culture in itself doesn't mean that. The word culture just means care. This is a command given to man to care for nature, to care for the world, to look after it and to use it properly. That's what we mean by the word culture here. God gives man a cultural mandate. God commands man to care for the world and to use it rightly. Now, this command here, this mandate in verse 28, you'll see it's broken down into four sub-commands. And I want to look at these in turn. Firstly, God says to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and increase in number. The first thing he commands them to do as part of this cultural mandate is to have children. He wants them to be fruitful and he wants them to increase in number. He wants them to make love to one another. And then as a result of that, he wants them to have children. And he wants the number of the human race to grow steadily. I think the implication of the words is that their desire should be to have more than two children. Because there's already two of them, but in each generation the number of the human race is to be increased. If they are to increase in number, they have to have more than two children. That's certainly true after the flood. Their numbers at this point, well, death wasn't in the world. But once death had come into the world, and then after the flood, God repeated this command and said again to the human beings alive then, be fruitful and increase in number. He was certainly telling them to have more than two children. That is the norm that God lays down, that man is to be constantly increasing in number with each generation. And then, following on from that, God says to them, fill the earth. That makes it plain why they've got to increase in number. It's because he wants them to spread out over the whole world. He wants them to move out in all directions. At the moment, they're living in one tiny little bit of the world. Adam and Eve are living in the Garden of Eden, in one pleasure park. But he wants their children and their children's children and their children's children's children, as they increase in number, to move out from that garden and to spread out into all the distant parts of the world. The earth is to be full of human beings. That's what God commanded. And then, the third aspect of the command, he says, fill the earth and subdue it. As they move out throughout the earth, they're to bring the earth under control. At the moment, the earth, when I say at the moment, when God spoke these words to man, the earth was a beautiful place. It was a wonderful place. It was a place where everything was very good, but it hadn't been developed in any way. Everything was just growing naturally. But Adam and Eve were told, what I want of you and your children is that they should move out, fill the earth and subdue it. They must bring it all under control. You're living in a garden. Well, I want you to extend that garden across the whole world. The world wasn't to be a wilderness, just uncontrolled natural growth. The world was to become a garden, subdued by man. Start thinking about what that would mean, to subdue the earth. It would mean to bring it all under control and then to develop all its hidden potential. As the children of Adam move out through the world, they're going to carve out mountain passes to reach places that couldn't be reached otherwise. And they're going to turn the prairies of the world into farms and gardens. And they're going to build bridges to span the great rivers. And they're going to build dams to provide power sources. And they're going to build great highways crisscrossing the earth. And they're going to cut down trees. And from the wood, they're going to build boats. And then, using those boats, they're going to cross the oceans of the world. And wherever they go, they're going to be seeking out the hidden resources of the world. They're going to find silver and gold. And from that silver and gold, they're going to produce beautiful jewelry. And they're going to mine precious stones. And they're going to polish those stones and cut them and set them in the jewelry. And they're going to take wood. And they're going to turn and they're going to shape it to make violins and harps so as to make music. And they're going to smelt copper and tin and make brass and then produce horns and trumpets. They're going to start orchestras. They're going to take silicon and copper and they're going to build computers. Bit by bit, they're going to discover all the potential that God has hidden in the world. That's the mandate God's given them. Subdue the earth. Take hold of it. Take control of it. Use it. That's the work that God has given them to do. They and the human race after them. Because they're the kings of the earth. Under God himself. They're to grow different varieties of plants in the places where they want them to be. They're to grow wheat fields and then turn the wheat into bread. They're going to grow herbs and spices and they're going to discover how different flavours can be blended. They're going to produce marvellous new dishes. God has put the potential for this into his creation. And so man has got the delightful task of discovering all that potential, of making nature serve him. And then the fourth aspect of this mandate is that they are to rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Not only are they to control, to subdue the earth and to use the plants that grow on it, but they are to command all the creatures, all the living creatures. Earlier there's been a division made, back in verse 24, there are livestock. Those are creatures that naturally submit to man, creatures like goats and sheep. But there are also creatures that move along the ground, and there are wild animals, creatures that are designed to roam loose in the world, giraffes and elephants maybe. But all of them are to be ruled by man. They are all supposed to fulfill, their destiny is to obey man's commands. You wouldn't want an elephant living in your back garden. You wouldn't want an elephant as a domestic pet. Elephants are supposed to be there striding through the jungles. But they're to stride there where man tells them to stride. Man has the authority to impose his will upon all the creatures, because God has appointed man to have dominion. There's the fourfold cultural mandate. Have children. Spread out. Fill the whole earth. Subdue the earth. Discover its potential. Harness that potential. Make use of it all. And rule the beasts. Now let me say again that man is commanded to do these things under the kingship of God. Man is not an autonomous king. Man is not a king who answers to nobody and nothing but himself. Man is always to remember that the world over which he rules is God's world, and that he must do it according to God's will. A man was never authorized to use the world selfishly, greedily. He was never authorized to exploit it and to damage it and to pollute it and to spoil it. He was to remember that God made it very good, and his task was to make it even better with the skills that God gave him. Not to spoil it, but to enhance it. You know, if you do take a rough diamond that's been mined, then the jeweler takes hold of it and he begins to shape it, to bring out its facets, to make it into something of ever greater beauty. And his job isn't to spoil it, to obscure it. It's to bring out what a beautiful thing it can be, to bring out all its potential. Well, that was to be man's role as king, to fill the whole earth, and then to bring out all the beauty, all the potential, all the splendor that God had built into his world, and thus to bring glory to God. The Garden of Eden was, as it were, the first temple. The place where God came down to dwell with man. And it was a temple worthy of God. It was a place of astonishing beauty because it had been cultivated by God's own hands. But man's task was to turn the whole earth into a temple fit for God. Develop it into something worthy of the God whose glory it was to reflect. That is the cultural mandate. That is the mandate by which God was given, by which God gave dominion to man. Now, when you look at those verses, when you look at verse 29, and the commands that God gives to man there, then immediately you begin to realize that This is not the favourite verse of the politically correct in our generation. You begin to realise that there is a deep set resentment in our anti-God society against these commands of God. The first command, which says, be fruitful and increase in number. How much propaganda there is in our society discouraging people from having children. It's relentless. People are being told more and more insistently that it is irresponsible for them to be fruitful and to multiply. They're being told that it is their duty to refrain from having children. And you see more and more people who are willing to listen to that propaganda, have decided that they will ignore this command of God, that they are in rebellion against it. You see it on an individual level. More and more couples who simply decide that they do not want to have children and they will not have children. We're not talking here about people who can't have children for physical reasons. We're not talking about people for whom there are extraordinary circumstances that would make it unwise for them to have children. We're talking about people who have simply decided that they do not want children and that it would interfere with their real good, with the sort of lifestyle that they want. It would interfere with their desire for fulfillment. And so they make that decision. But it's not only on that personal level. It's on a global level. There is a hugely influential anti-population movement across the world today. All across the world, huge resources are being poured into limiting or reducing the population of the globe. And there is this determination that man will not be allowed to be fruitful and increase in number. I read recently a fascinating article by a lady called Mary Haynes, who's a researcher in this matter of population and population control. She trained at Princeton and then in Oxford. And she talks here about how she first became aware of the anti-procreation movement, particularly in the third world. She says, a few years ago, I was working on a mobile clinic in Western Kenya. Returning from one of our many tours, we found a desperately sick woman lying across the road. Her condition was critical, so we drove her to the nearest government hospital 5 hours away. When we arrived, she was too weak to walk, so I carried her into the reception room, shoving the cows aside. Because the doctor was in the local bar, drunk, we decided to speak with the pharmacist, a kindly man whose pharmacy contained nothing beyond a bottle of penicillin and 75,000 condoms from the US Agency for International Development. There were no gloves, no syringes, no vitamins, no basic medical supplies, but 75,000 condoms from USAID. That first contact, she says, with population control intrigued me and led me to dig a little. And the more I dug, the more I came to realize that the population control program is really a ruthless campaign. She was shocked by the priorities in that situation. The West hadn't poured resources in to supply that hospital with medical help for the sick, but it gives them all the resources that they need in order to try to control the local population. In the course of her article, she talks about some of the situations she's become aware of throughout the world. In India, sterilization squads rounded up people and sterilized them against their will. In Peru, we hear of women receiving food for their undernourished children only if they consented to being sterilized. Sometimes no consent is given. Victoria Espinosa, for example, a Peruvian woman, had gone to her local hospital to deliver her baby. Tragically, the baby boy died shortly after birth, yet Victoria was nevertheless determined to have another baby, until she discovered that her doctor had secretly sterilized her. "When I heard that," she said, "something deep in my heart broke. Now there's a terrible hole inside." In Indonesia, obstinate women have had IUDs inserted at gunpoint. From Bangladesh, the Philippines, Haiti, Sri Lanka come repeated reports of women being refused food and medical treatment unless they consented to sterilization. In Brazil, 7.5 million women have been sterilized, many against their will. In Mexico, government doctors will tie a woman's tubes with or without consent after delivery of her third child. Programs like these make many women reluctant to accept official medical care or even food. There is such fear in Mexico, for instance, that government medical personnel are sterilizing women without their consent that it's reported Mexicans avoid government clinics. In the Sudan, an aid worker found women refusing milk and most other food because they were frightened that it had been laced with sterilizing agents. They preferred to die in their tents. And then, of course, there are the horrendous stories about the one-child policy in China. Women are being forcibly aborted even at 9 months and sterilized. Officials will fine families out of existence if they break the one-child rule and even burn down their houses. There is a reign of terror in the countryside. Frightened women go into hiding or throw their forbidden babies into ditches. And all this is supported directly or indirectly by agencies like USAID, the International Planned Parenthood Federation, and United Nations Fund for Population Activities. They supply the drugs and IUDs and equipment. They set up abortion units. They teach local people how to sterilize and insert IUDs and abort. Millions of pounds, £20 million from the UK alone, are donated by Western countries and Japan to the International Planned Parenthood Federation, to the United Nations Fund for Population Activities every year. Even the Irish government is now contributing generously. And when President Bush halted federal funding of four foreign abortion and sterilization programs, the European Union dipped into its coffers to make good the shortfall. Here from the West, there is enormous pressure being put on people across the world. Don't be fruitful. Don't multiply. Now, how is that justified? How do they justify that philosophy? Well, initially, there is no question. The people who pioneered the whole anti-population movement did so on eugenic grounds. This was Margaret Sanger, who founded Planned Parenthood in the 90s. She said that the problem in the world are inferior races who are overrunning the human garden like weeds. That was the logic. We can't afford to have inferior races. They are genetically inferior. And that's why they need to be sterilized. They must be prevented from being fruitful and multiplying. Well, of course, nobody likes being heard to use language like that nowadays. It's not respectable to do so. And so what we hear instead is endless propaganda about world resources and how the world doesn't have the resources to support an increasing population, how food supplies will run out, and how it isn't possible to grow enough food on Earth to feed a growing population, or about how the mineral supplies of the world will run out. The world will run out of copper and tin and natural gas and so on if we don't cull the population. And again, if you try to find the hard evidence to support those sort of claims, well, it's just not there. But it's repeated again and again. And then, of course, there's the third claim, which is that high population levels are the root cause of poverty across the world. And that is the claim that of all is hardest to sustain. The great problem in Africa is not overpopulation. It is underpopulation. The reason why there is so much poverty across Africa is because there is not the population to make use of the resources, to develop the potential of wonderfully fertile and potentially rich countries. There are other factors as well, but that is a huge factor. Read anything. Read any studies of the relation between population and poverty within Africa, and they all come to the same conclusion. The great problem of Africa is underpopulation. But all the time, the idea is sold through our media that we need to cull the world's population, or at least we need to prevent it from growing any further. Otherwise, there'll be mass poverty, mass starvation. First dimension of the cultural mandate: be fruitful, increase in number. That's under attack. Rebellious man in our world is saying no, no, no to that. That command was repeated after the flood, as I've said. I suppose somebody might argue, well, you know, it was all very well giving a command like that in a perfect world, in an unfallen world, in a world that hadn't been cursed. But of course, you'd have to modify that command now, wouldn't you? Now that the world is fallen, now that there is a curse on the earth, now that there are thorns and thistles, one has to be more determined to restrain population growth. It's not so. As I say, the command was repeated after the flood, that it was still God's will that the children of Noah should be fruitful and should multiply. And then the second dimension of this cultural mandate was that they should fill the earth, that they should spread out across the world, and that they should develop the whole world. I don't mean that every part of the world should be turned into Kew Gardens. What I mean is that man should have access to the whole world, and that he should use every part of the world in the way that under God's guidance seems wisest and best. But there were to be no no-go areas across the earth. He was to survey the whole world. He was to fill the whole world and make use of the whole world. Now, I've put the same question to a number of different folk in the last fortnight as I've been thinking about this passage. I've put a question to some of you based on a research report that was published by the Royal Geographical Society. I've asked you the question: what proportion of the Earth's surface today is wilderness? What I mean by that, or what the report means by that, a wilderness is defined as an area minimum size 1 million acres. If you don't have 1 million acres, then we're not even including it in the figures. And we define a wilderness as empty of roads, settlements, buildings, airports, railways, pipelines, power lines, canals, causeways, aqueducts, mines, dams, reservoirs, oil wells. Even the discovery of tire tracks across ice or tundra rules it out as a wilderness. So you've got to find an area of 1 million acres in which really there is no trace of human contact at all. On that basis, What proportion of the world's land surface is still wilderness? Most people say, well, a tiny proportion. At least a third of the world's land surface is still complete wilderness. Obviously, you think of Antarctica, where virtually all of Antarctica is still wilderness. But Canada is 65% wilderness. The Soviet Union is 34% wilderness. Australia is 30% wilderness. There are vast areas of wilderness across the world. Again, the propaganda is that the whole world is overpopulated and that the wildernesses of the world have vanished. It's not true. There are still vast parts of the world that man has yet to fill, where man has yet to establish his control. And he's been authorized by God to do it. And man must fill Antarctica. And man must take control of the great mountain ranges. And man must take control of the deserts. We're told within Scripture that the desert shall bloom like a rose. And on a tiny scale, the Israelis have set out to do that. They've taken areas that were complete desert. And they've turned them into fertile farms. That's man's responsibility under God, to take the most unpromising parts of the earth and to fill them, to make them habitable. And then this command to subdue the earth. And again, you're conscious, aren't you, of just how hostile much opinion is against the whole idea of development. By definition, in the eyes of some people, to begin to subdue the world, to begin to develop it, to begin to mine it, to begin to build roads, is seen as something in itself evil. I was talking to a young man about the remarkable road along the Welsh coast, the A5. And how they've carved tunnels through the living rock in order to take that dual carriageway right across to Anglesey. And he shook his head in disgust and said, what right had they to do that? Not because he was a Welsh nationalist, but because to him it was a horrific idea that man should dare to carve a hole in a mountain. Well, his home wouldn't be the comfortable place it is if really there were no mining, if nobody were at work developing the potential of the world. That hadn't occurred to him. But to him, it was just unthinkable that there should be that sort of development on earth. You have your eco-warriors who make it their goal to stand in the way of any sort of development, any sort of subduing of the earth. God has commanded man to subdue the earth. God has commanded man to develop industry, to take things and to build them, to experiment and discover what you can make out of all the resources he's put in the world. God has given these commands, but there is this intense opposition and growing opposition to that. And then the fourth aspect, this command to rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Again, you know of some people who would rage against such language. Man ruling the beasts, man ruling the creatures, man has no right to rule the animals. They're his equals. This is pure speciesism. I read to you, I wrote in the church bulletin last year an article about environmentalism. And in preparation for that, I read all sorts of stuff from different ecological websites. And I gave you some of the choicest quotes. And let me read you a couple that I chose then. Our own human striving for self-realization is on an equal footing to the strivings of other beings. There is a fundamental equality between human and non-human life in principle. Fundamental equality. Man has no more right to rule his dog than the dog has to rule the man. Gaia theorists acknowledge humanity as important, but only important through being a creation of Gaia, Mother Earth. For deep ecologists, humans are no different from and no more important than worms or viruses. Man has no more right to kill a virus than the virus has to kill the man. Well, for people who think like that, you can see that a verse like this is blasphemy. To suggest that it's for man to rule the beasts, to command them, to decide what their place in the world is, to allocate them to that place. When you hear of people campaigning against the wearing of fur, Or saying that we've got no right to make shoes out of leather, no right to breed animals for their skins, no right to cull a seal population or cull badgers if we believe they're carrying foot and mouth disease, or to kill foxes or shoot crows or whatever it may be. When you hear of people who talk in those terms, remember what lies behind it. It's not just that they're soggy, sentimental people. It's that they really have, consciously or not, taken in the philosophy that man doesn't have the right to rule the beasts. In all these different aspects, man is in rebellion against God. It's striking, isn't it? The first phrase of the verse. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and all the rest. This was God pronouncing a blessing upon man. God gave this mandate because in doing these things, man would find blessing and happiness, fulfillment. This wasn't a cruel, evil thing that God was imposing upon man. God was saying to man, you're my special children. You're my best beloved. I've given you these wonderful privileges. Take these blessings from my hand. Take this blessing from my hand. Be fruitful, increase in number. Take this blessing from my hand. Fill the earth. Take this blessing from my hand. Subdue it, use it. Take this blessing from my hand. Rule the beasts. These were blessings that God was pronouncing on man. And rebellious man spits at a God who wants to give him blessings. You know, sometimes you see it, don't you, with a child who's in a rage. Your child has been disobedient and he's angry with you over something. And then you offer him something delightful. You offer him the present he's been wanting, asking for weeks. And he goes, I don't want it! And he throws it on the floor. And he rejects it out of his anger for you, against you, the hatred he's feeling towards you at that moment. Man is in rebellion against God. And that is why when God comes and offers mankind these lovely, beautiful gifts, these wonderful blessings, instead of just taking them with joy and thanksgiving, man throws them back in God's face and says, "We're not going to be fruitful and multiply, not if you tell us to. We're not going to fill the earth, no. We're not going to subdue it. We don't want to rule your rotten animals." That's the attitude. Man, sulky, rebellious against the Creator he's wronged. When you hear of the cranky extremes of environmentalism, don't laugh. Don't laugh at it. Cry. Cry when you see just the utter folly. How foolish men and women can become when they are locked into enmity against God. They resent even his gifts. They resent the commands that he gives them to make them happy. Well, this vision, this mandate, will it ever be fulfilled? Will man ever really take control over the whole of nature? Will man ever be a worthy king over God's creation? Will man ever have his proper role as king under God's kingship again? Again, we've read in the last couple of weeks, Hebrews chapter 2. Let's just look at it again, just to remind ourselves that God's purpose has not failed, that God still is planning to fulfill his purposes. This is what the writer to the Hebrews says. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 5. "It is not to angels that God has subjected the world to come about which we're speaking. Who will rule the world to come, the new heavens and the new earth? To whom will the world be subjected? Not to angels," says the writer. "But there's a place where someone has testified, 'What is man that you're mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him. You made him a little lower than the angels.'" That's where we are at the moment. We've got a lower status than that of the angels. "But you crowned him with glory and honor and put everything under his feet." The writer says, remember, that is man's destiny. He's crowned with glory and honor. He's to have everything put under his feet. In putting everything under him, God left nothing that's not subject to him. So God's plan is that, yes, literally everything in all creation is to be subject to man. Yet at present, we don't see everything subject to him. Nature is in rebellion against man, as man is in rebellion against God. But we do see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. No, we're not seeing all mankind fulfilling his destiny, but we are seeing one man already. We're seeing Jesus sitting as king, crowned with glory and honor. Jesus, the man, even now can say, "All authority in heaven and on earth is given to me." And the writer goes on to say, "In bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the author of their salvation perfect through suffering." All God's true children, all who are chosen in Christ, all who are redeemed in Christ, all the people who make up the true humanity, the real human race, all of them will be brought to glory with Jesus. All of them will share his position of kingship. All will be crowned with glory and honor along with Jesus. The vision that's there in those words in Genesis 2 hasn't failed. Yes, sin has invaded. And sin has turned man from being a king into being a slave. But one day, through Christ, men and women, restored in the image of God, will share the dominion of Jesus Christ. The whole universe will be that precious jewel. The whole universe will be that one great garden. And man really will rule, sharing the throne of Jesus Christ, who shares the throne of God. Our destiny is bigger. It's more glorious than most of us have ever thought, than any of us can ever imagine. Think of Adam. Think of the greatness, the majesty of Adam. He stands before God and God says to him, rule. Take this earth as your own. Rule over it. One day we shall hear those words said to us again, if we belong to Christ. In giving Jesus Christ to us as our Saviour, God has given us the whole universe for our delight. It's all ours if we belong to Him.